Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to GoTo Unscripted. So today, we're going to have some interesting conversations around platform engineering. I'm Ajay Chankramath. I'm the founder and CEO of Platformetrics, where we actually look at how to actually sort of break down the problems organizations have in their platform engineering journey. Nick?
Yeah, hi. Nick Chankramath with ThoughtWorks and principal technologist there and deeply involved in a variety of different ways where we build and put platforms into use with large customers.
For the listeners who are not familiar, Nick and I used to be colleagues. We used to work together a lot for many years. And then we sort of went in a slight, or rather I went in a slightly different way, but I'm doing a few other things. But the good thing is that we have been working on some books together and some research and things like that together. So Nick, I'm thinking that maybe we should keep the conversations sort of around that platform engineering space and some of the things that we talked about in the book and some of the newer things that are coming up right now. What do you think?
Yeah, no, sounds good.
Awesome. So I'll probably kick it off with some thoughts, and I would like to hear your thoughts too, Nick, and maybe we can sort of build on it. One of the things I think we covered in the book a lot is about this product mindset from a platform point of view, right? I mean, so sometimes that's overused and not quite well understood and all that. So I know we have, I think, what, at least two specific chapters where we are talking about it. Why is that needed kind of thing, right? From your point of view, you know, if you think about it, like, why is that product mindset needed for platform engineering?
Yeah, I mean, it ties right back to the results you're going to get out of it. And it's hard to develop. A lot of companies that have great product mindsets when they're literally facing their external outside customers, they've developed those muscles. They're pretty good at it, or they at least think in those terms, and they're always getting feedback from customers in that sense. But with internal products, it's all over the place, and a lot of organizations have never really thought about it that way. And so they've never sort of developed a sense of looking at something and saying, oh, that's a terrible product experience, when they're delivering it to internal customers. And they've just thought in terms of, can I get something done? You know, and there's always time pressure in that. So thinking about it that way is, it takes a bigger upfront investment, but the rewards are tremendous. You know, the productivity and the sustainability of something that you've built to ship and sustain, obviously it's going to be different than just the, you know, quickest path.
Yeah, I mean, so just to add to that, I think one of the things that I've been talking about a lot more recently is, like, you know, what are those transformational patterns? Because people say, like, okay, I'm doing this, you know, platform as a product. But yeah, I'm asking the end users to see, like, okay, what do they need? And am I actually going to do this right? Right. But there is this cycle that I've been thinking about and talking about a little bit more recently. It's like, yeah, you're one of the primary goals in there is to sort of standardize everything that either end users are doing or within an enterprise. Then you start thinking about orchestrating some of those kinds of things. And then comes the whole contextualization part of it. If you are working in a financial services company versus like a telecom or something, like, how does that context gets into this whole idea of building the infrastructure the right way? And, you know, I'm sure we will get to this conversation later on, but that AI part of it, right? How do you actually apply AI to it? Because now it's not the question of whether I should or not. It's a question of, like, how do I do it? So I talk about this in the context of maybe supervised AI as opposed to agentic AI kind of thing, right? So what I'm thinking of in these kinds of spaces are, like, things like when you talk about standardization, you know, we all have been talking about golden paths, right? I mean, golden paths have been that backbone of a lot of things that you do in IDPs and all that, you know, trying to make sure that majority of the users, not all of them, but majority of the users have a standard way of getting things done. But then comes that interesting part, which I think we covered a lot in the book. I know you did some heavy lifting within that space, right? The whole idea of control planes. So the way I think of control planes is mostly around, how do you actually take that developer intent? Like, developer wants to do something. I want to deploy a Postgres database or whatever, right? And then how do you actually translate that into the architectural part of it, the actual infrastructure build out part of it? I would love to hear some of your thoughts. I know it's been evolving over time, right? But since you did some heavy lifting within that book, I would love to hear your thoughts on that orchestration part of it.
Right. Yeah, I think it goes back to, like you're saying, with a control plane, the hope is that we want to build everything API first. So whatever capability we're going to create there, provide to developers, behind it is an API. And frequently, it's not one you have to create. I mean, obviously, if you're working on a cloud provider, they've done that. And so you can expose those things. But everything else, when you talk about, like you say, a golden path for developers for interacting with the things they most commonly use, it's like, I still want to present an API to them so that it's a convention, if you will. It's a standard that they get for low, you know, effort. It's just boom, they can deploy it. But it's also an API endpoint, so they can therefore, when they need to break out of that mold for whatever reason, they have a place to start. And it's like standard, I got a 1-inch pipe, I need to go to a 1/2-inch, I can just get a step down thing, you know, because there's a set of conventions and standards that they can follow. So that's what we're always looking for, is when I expose it, how can I do it either directly if it's a third party thing that maybe comes that way, or in a way that gives you those guardrails. And that's where a control plane comes in, because it's like, it lets me wrap, like AWS or Google Cloud or Azure or something, lets me wrap the default thing with those standards, while at the same time having a mechanism for them to go direct and get whatever else maybe the cloud provider offers in that space that they need access to, and completely self-serve.
Yeah, and I think I like the fact that, you know, one of the things that we have talked about a lot, and, you know, I know that we do these things in our day-to-day, you know, work, is sort of positioning Kubernetes as that control plane foundation, right? And, you know, that's the way I think we are covering this too. Sort of in practical terms, one thing that, you know, again, I was talking to somebody like a couple of weeks back at a conference, and one of the things that came up was that, so how does this sort of commitment to this Kubernetes API, which I think you touched upon, sort of simplify that whole work the platform engineers are doing for managing all the cloud APIs and all that, you know? So, and I think you also alluded to this aspect of self-healing, which is, you know, sort of important, right? I mean, because when you're building some of these things, how can Control Plane help with that process, right? So how do you see that Kubernetes API sort of helping this process?
Yeah, imagine if it wasn't there and you were just thinking, I need to build this, which is what, you know, Google was doing with Borg way back. It was like, I've got this problem I need to solve. And if I do automate it and provide it in a highly resilient way, what things do I have to do? You know, it's like, I need this reconciliation loop that's constantly checking the state and then responding to it, comparing it to what the user asked for, and has it drifted, and how do I put it back? And so that whole set of things, what constitutes health, and can I continuously check it? And so it's a very resilient, highly tested, probably more community focus on that control loop than just about any other one that we've got, you know, available to us. And it's extensible. It's meant to be used like this. So you can readily extend it to something it doesn't understand, but you'll still apply that same logical loop. So rather than rebuild all that by hand and try to achieve that same level of resiliency and, you know, broad community understanding, which would be very difficult, it's like, let's just use it for what it is. And we create lots of like platform products where what most people think of Kubernetes is, I don't want to deploy my API or something to run there, and they think of it that way, or this COTS that runs on Kubernetes. We'll deploy a control plane where they don't even know it's Kubernetes, maybe, and they're not needing Kubernetes in the sense that they're not trying to deploy APIs, they're trying to build other kinds of infrastructure, but that's the API interface we give to them so that they get all those other things we were talking about from the experience. And it's like, why reinvent the wheel? It's sitting right there and relatively cheap to provide compared to, you know, custom writing all that.
Yeah, absolutely right. So sort of related to that is, like, while you're sort of applying the IAC to some of the foundational aspects of it, right? And I think, you know, there's a term that was introduced, again, maybe we didn't introduce it, you know, it was always been that idea of dump pipelines and smart scripts kind of thing, right?
Yeah. You know, play on the API development, right?
Yeah, exactly. Term. I mean, so from my point of view, that is sort of that vital cog in that wheel, right? And it's sort of ensuring that, you know, if we are really trying to get the platforms to evolve over time, which is some of the themes that we are seeing a lot more, right? When this whole idea of how much of maintenance has to be there for a platform, how do you actually keep platforms maintained properly, and, you know, evolve it and scale it properly, right? So,
yeah. What do you see going on? Because you're tied into a lot of what companies are looking for, and they're out reaching out into the market. What do you see as them being more interested across that spectrum of stuff?
I think that's a great question, right? Because sometimes, you know, it just happened that just today, like an hour back, I was having a meeting with one of the clients who are like a big player within the educational technology space. And one of the things that they have been talking about is like, we tried to put these things in place. So they have been actually on their platform journey for about 3 years or something like that. They initially called it DevOps, and then they started scaling and abstracting all the capabilities into a separate team, and their DevOps team is doing something else from an operational point of view. Their challenge is precisely in that evolution side of things, right? So they built a bunch of things. Now they are finding it extremely complex to manage those. And this is where that separation of duty sort of come in. I think we are discussing this in a book too, right? The whole idea of shared responsibility model, right? So their challenge is that, they initially thought that, when you're setting up this shared responsibility model, you will have a situation where, the platform teams would build it and then they would maintain these things all the time, which has led to a situation where even their pipelines are being actually maintained by the platforms team, which is an anti-pattern. So I was telling them that, that's probably the wrong thing. So if you think that pipelines are owned by platform engineering, you have already failed. That is not the whole intent of platform engineering, because then we haven't achieved anything by doing all of this, right?
Yeah, that's one of, there's so many different things we do, or like that adds a 2% improvement. That adds, which are valuable when you add them all together. But there's a few things that you do that just are like, no, that's a 10%. If you can say it, major buyback of time and removal of friction. Developers maintaining ownership of pipelines is a key one. And especially ThoughtWorks. I mean, we, basically invented doing that and with control and cruise control and back in the day kind of thing. And it's like that whole notion was created for developers and for developer concerns. And then it got co-opted by, everybody for their concerns and turned it into something that, like I said, it can work contrary to what you're trying to achieve. But if you do that, then like you're pointing out, there's some very particular architectural outcomes you need to meet. Otherwise, it's just difficult and it becomes hard and you don't want that,
Yeah. Exactly. And with these guys, right, one of the other challenges is that they are apparently using Backstage, and they've been on that Backstage journey for a while. And, it hasn't been very successful because I don't know about you. I mean, so when I talk to a lot of these clients, a lot of these newer clients in my current role, one thing I find is there's so many people are getting started on the Backstage. Everybody wants to get started on the Backstage, but the number of people who are really finishing that journey and really getting something out of it seems to be really, really low, right?
Yeah.
And I think part of it is, we have to sort of blame ourselves for setting up that stage that, I think a lot of us talk about Backstage as that holy grail of, everything. And people don't even talk about it as portals. And then they think like, oh, that is the platform kind of thing, right? So I think one thing I was telling them was that, just because having a Backstage should not give you that false comfort saying that, now I've implemented the platform. Now, if I provide a button for my developers to push, I'm successful. And you're not, right? Because like you said, the backend is not properly set up. Whether it is like those role-based network structures and things like that, we have discussed in the book and things like that. Those architectural choices are usually the biggest challenges the way I see it.
It can be a complete, I call it a crap magnet, if not done well. And then that's the whole point. It's a touch point. It's a UI where a lot of teams, a lot of companies don't have an alternative that provides that same function, but they don't implement it like that. Right. It's very tempting, especially if you look through the quick start guides and stuff on Backstage to get sucked into that pattern of saying, oh, everything's just a plugin and everything. And it becomes performs the business logic, if you will, behind standing up platforms. And it's like, no, it wasn't built for that. It does not designed to do that. It's not what you can do that, but should you do that is another problem. And the other thing is people think, well, I'm just starting. I mean, one team's going to use it. We'll cut corners to get that one team on it. And it's like, well, there's value in experimenting and finding out what those teams actually need before investing in it. But if you literally don't have the time to implement it right, why do you think you're going to have the time to fix it, later? And that's the point. And then you double down and then the problems get, compounded.
Right. And so in talking about, because even like yesterday, I was doing another conversation with another person and this sort of came up yet again, right? It's about like, so if everybody says you're going on the backstage journey and at some point you're not really getting the right kind of value out of it. So the question really is like, people turn around and ask, okay, so what do I do, right? So I think one of the things that we are talking about is that, making sure that your architectural decisions behind the scenes are sort of something that can help with this. I know that in our book, one of the things that, you know, we emphasized was this whole idea of how do you actually, you know, sort of translate these things into the organizational risk management, right? Again, so as you're trying to scale it, you build something. And so that's why, you know, backstage POCs look very good, right? Because, you know, it has got a front end and all that kind of things. But then when you really start scaling is when you start seeing some of these larger problems, whether it is really trying to see, like, you know, can I onboard more developers, or can I actually have better intents from the developers translated into the kind of outcomes that I need? So I think we covered a bunch of those things. And maybe you might want to touch upon some of the things like those control plane extensions aspects that we spoke about in the book, right?
Yeah, I mean, ask it again. Think about like the way when your customers talk, like the one you were mentioning is having challenges at scale. So like from their perspective, how would they frame the question of like on what's going wrong or what are we struggling with? How do you think that would?
Yeah, and So I think in more often than not, they don't know, right? I mean, which especially goes back to trying to measure some of these things, you know, and measuring is a huge aspect of how we should be improving any of these things, you know, to state the obvious. But as you're really trying to do that, organizations even struggle to measure that because they tend to jump into Adora metrics and things like that, which is a giant leap from where their problems are to the whole the manifestation of those problems, right? I mean, yeah. So sometimes it becomes like, can we actually break down the basic problems the way they see it and then start building on it? You know, sometimes it's like, you know, you talked about the API side of things. Sometimes if they're setting up the APIs, maybe that is not being consumed properly within their CLI side of things. You know, maybe, you know, they are trying to invent the developer touch points becomes like something that is somewhat spread out as opposed to that's more unified. So finding some of those problems are, to me, the key to really figuring out why people aren't seeing the value that they would expect.
Right. Or like I say, if you knew as a company that you wanted to provide, you know, oversimplified, but you wanted to provide a great, you know, mobile experience to your customers, you'd be thinking in terms of, well, we need folks who are familiar with mobile and, you know, the issues, whether it's on the shaping what the app should be like, or just building, you know, what you think you want to build. You'd know that, and you'd hire that way, or you'd train that way, or you'd engage with a vendor like that. But oftentimes internal products, people don't do that, right? You'll get some folks together who are familiar with DevOps ideas and say, well, you know, yeah, you're going to build a platform without any, you know, product support. It's not uncommon for people to be effective in a full stack team doing DevOps who aren't coders. They don't build APIs. They don't work in any of those spaces, which, you know, they haven't needed to. Why jump into it? But if you're going to build a platform, you do need some of your people in this product team who will build and shape those things. You're never going to get to a platform experience based off solely off third-party tools integrated in the ways that are just out of the box with them. You'll always have to write something custom. You just try to minimize that, you know, and make choices that keep that as not complex as possible. Make it as simple as possible, but not simpler, right? Yeah. Paraphrasing. So I think it's a big part of it.
Yeah, the thing is that I thought, at least when I started doing some of these things many years back, you know, that was a whole promise, right? I mean, yeah. Being able to make sure that your domain APIs, you know, what irrespective of the domains that you're doing, and the domains can actually translate, the domain requests can be translated through APIs to your infrastructure decisions, right? So that even if you are not an expert at the infrastructure side of things, yes, you have your platform teams or, you know, DevOps teams and people like that who can help with that process, but that intent translation has to happen from a domain side of things, right? And that generally seems to be, there still seems to be like a sort of a gap between those two, right? People are still looking at this like, here is this infra silo, and now we infra capability, build out silos, the platform engineering, but I'm still going to be doing my product thing. So I think bridging that gap is where, and that's where I think that those control plane discussions that you're having in the book, I think that's where it sort of, at least when I go back and reread it myself, right, that's what I sort of gleaned from it.
Right. Well, that domain design, that's just done badly, or like not doing it at all. That's a way to do it badly. You know, it's like if you don't aim for something, you're definitely going to hit it. And when you start, we switch from doing infrastructure in traditional ways to say we're going to do it in software. It's like, okay, well then why don't you think all those software needs and problems and engineering strategies aren't going to come with it? They absolutely will. And so we need good, strong domain design within the platform product so that whatever part needs to grow and scale or be managed by that team over there, whatever it might be, that it has domain boundaries that we've tested. They work like APIs. They work. If it was on your business side of your product, you'd be hopefully very concerned about those things. If you were going into a distributed service architecture, you'd say, how do I know I've got this domain boundary right? It's not just wherever I want it to be. It's where it can work. And I know that because teams aren't stepping on each other. They're not in the same code base. They can evolve and ship quickly without dependencies across, teams and all those kinds of things. You do the same thing in a platform to get that outcome, if that's what you need.
Right. So again, for the listeners who may not be very familiar with the domain-driven design or applying some of the domain concepts here, right? So maybe you want to just throw out a couple of examples, like, what would be a typical example of that bounded context of a domain and all that in this case?
In a platform, you mean?
Yeah.
We do there. It's like, well, like often the control plane itself, if you're buying that from someone or self-managing, in other words, it if you think of Kubernetes, GKE and Google Cloud or something, there's what my vendor manages inside of that. And there's what I manage on top of that, because I'm always deploying stuff. Maybe my end users are too, but I always will as a platform builder. And so that's a clean line needs to be drawn around. If it's with GKE, what is everything that Google manages for me in this that, in fact, I'm paying them to manage, and getting that in its own SDLC pipeline around it and everything, so that I can, whatever I need to do to, manage that build out is all in one place, and it's separate from what do I deploy on top of that? If I'm running a service mesh on top of that, it's a different pipeline maintained. It might be by a different team, depending on how large your platform is and what the scale is, so that you need a clean boundary. The team that's evolving Kubernetes is free to do that. GKE, there's not a lot to do if Google's managing it, but you are to choosing kind of when and where, what upgrades pattern you want to be on, and when certain things happen and when node upgrades happen and things like that. So you'll do it in a way that you don't interfere with anybody as you're going along with that. And likewise for the teams that build on top of it, so you create clean boundaries. Like I always tell people, if you've ever used an API for something, meaning third party, well-managed Google Maps to do something, you'll kind of get what the experience should be like. I get as much Google Maps as I need. Yeah. As little or as much whenever I need it on demand kind of thing. They may not have all the features I need today, but I don't call up Google and say, I need this. You could ask, but you have a workaround, but while you wait and see if maybe they can build that in someday and you don't need your workaround, all those experiences should be there with internal platform domains, and should work the same way. Whatever team's building, whatever, they can ship and evolve as quickly as there's value, and then other teams around them aren't blocked, aren't dependent. They're not, there's not 10 different meetings required in order to consume or use what they need, and vice versa, what, another part of the platform is building.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting thoughts, right? So I think we are almost running out of time. So I want to jump to the topic that I'm sure everybody's interested in hearing about, right? So off late, a lot of the people that I'm talking to, and I'm also doing some trainings around some of these things, right, is about the application of agentic AI in platform engineering, right? So the kind of things that I'm dealing with, I'm sure, are sort of slightly different from maybe things that you're dealing with. So kind of things I look at are things like, how do you apply AI solutions to sort of review the manual process and improve that whole experience, right? So this might be things like, exploring intelligent CI/CD and things like that, going from the self-service aspects to more of those self-optimization or self-evolving kind of solutions and all that. Some of the other things that I'm looking at are things like, I think we touched upon a few of these things in our book too, around things like the AI-enhanced observability, right? If you are doing anomaly detection and predictive analytics and all that. I know that ThoughtWorks is doing a bunch of things within that space. And while I was working at Brilio, we were also building a bunch of solutions like that. So I think I'm really, really seeing a lot of people having interest in addressing things like if I have my policy drift, if I have my issues with my operational inefficiencies, how do I actually use some agents to sort of fix that? In some cases, it's also maybe, things like a multi-agent simulation kind of thing, right? So you might have a cost optimization happening in one side and might have an incident response happening. How do you make those things sort of work together kind of thing? So I think there's been some really interesting aspects around that. So I'm sort of building a couple of solutions to at least a prototype and show it to people like, these are the kind of things that you could do within that space, right? What's been your journey in that AI in platform engineering space?
Dude, yeah, we've been fortunate to be able to work We work with, you know, probably the biggest company in that space in terms of how do the consumers of the hardware that you need to build new AI things, whether it's, you know, training completely new models or training, further training of a model. You might buy a, you know, a very recent, very advanced token database. You might use Llama, something open source, but you're tuning it with your own data. And it's like, so how do I evolve it to a point where it knows enough about my business and what I'm doing that I can start applying it to things in ways that I only ever before could get people to do? I don't think it takes away that human responsibility. That's the thing. If you can't assess everything AI tells you and know if it's correct or not, don't use it, kind of the thing, because it's that savant, I'm going to say idiot savant, is that even a term anymore? But it's that person who's like, can come up with brilliant things at sometimes, and other times they come up with things where it's like, are they even paying attention? It's like,
yeah.
And so doing that, and it's really interesting to focus on it and try to get, you know, and then also to offload the work as much as possible from the really expensive, you know, not many people get access to kind of gear. But that's where we're, most of the places where finding effective use are where it's taking something that's generalized and that has those attributes that we think of a large language model doing well, and then tuning it to the realities of the data of a particular customer or client, so that then it, you know, it sounds much more likely to provide the sort of help. If they put it in a support call, you're much more likely to get useful information. If you set it to analyzing metrics and logs and feedback from your cluster to try to help you catch things ahead of time, that it functions like another knowledgeable team member that owns up this operational space. It's coming up with ideas. And like most of us, you have a group of humans. We're going to come up with some good ideas, and we're going to come up with some bad ideas, you know, and AI just does it really fast. So really fast, here's a bunch of good ideas. And then here's like a whole slew of terrible ideas. But, you know, they don't ever go to sleep. They don't need time off. They don't, you know, so they're always there to help the team right. And contribute. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think your area seems really fascinating, right? How we are actually looking at it. From my point of view, my conversations and some of the work that I'm doing is really now starting with this idea. People are jumping in with, you know, this agentic automation approach to start with, kind of thing, you know, which sort of leads into this fragmented infrastructure because there's like no standards really as they're trying to do it. And all the bad things that they're doing gets amplified, right? Significantly amplified, right? Because if you don't build your foundation for your house right, you know, you're not going to build a house really, right? I mean, I think that's the way I see it. So I keep talking about, even when you were explaining it, I was thinking about like, how do you really try and get people to think about those standardized and all the things that we're talking about, those golden paths and building the right control planes and in ensuring that the domain level APIs that we talked about, all those things will happen with the supervised approach, which is what you're saying from a human in the loop idea, right? I mean, making sure you don't let AI run with it. So within that space that you are really looking at from a model side of things, you know, how do you sort of, maybe you are not in that spot yet, and how do you sort of convince that end users about that value of building the foundations right there?
Yeah, think about the stuff we do in pre-AI, or still along with AI, where, you know, you've got nodes in a cluster or standalone nodes where the disk drive, you know, it's really boring. Disk drive is filling up because the logs aren't trunking. The solution isn't to go, you know, truncate the file. The problem is there's not something running automatically that knows how much information should be kept, offloads it, and keeps it clean. So when we deploy AI, it's probably not going to say, oh, here's how you permanently fix that, so you never need to look for that. You don't need to worry about that happening again. It's probably just going to go, here, let me clean that up and, you know, erase those drives. Right. So it's the same idea. It's like it's going to propose a lot of ideas. It's going to run out and find things, but you can't just assume that the solutions will all be correct. Unless there's no value in it. Maybe you have a system that runs where it's going to run there unattended for, you know, it's a year and then be turned off. Who cares? It never needs to get better. So that's a case of saying, okay, well, I'm going to figure out what I need to do here and how to apply it and make the value meet the return, expected return. Kind of apply it that way. I'm always amazed though by someone, we're doing something with AI and it's like, if a human did that for you just like that, you'd fire them. You know, it's like, in other words, we wouldn't tolerate the things that AI is doing, but yet we're saying we're going to accept it from AI. I'm like, wait, what's going on? You know, I don't understand that. So apply at least the same standard, you know.
Exactly. And the whole non-deterministic nature of some of these things makes it so sort of annoying, right? Again, more than anything else, it just annoys the heck out of me when I try and start you make some move towards it. I'm starting to trust this a little bit more. All non-deterministic side of things comes in and said, I'm done. I'm not going to touch
it. It's math. It doesn't know anything. Yeah. It's just math.
Anyway. Yeah, so again, you might be, I don't know if you saw that survey. So we actually did something called the State of AI in Platform Engineering kind of a survey. And the data that jumped out was really interesting, right? So, you know, we asked about like literally thousands of developers, like, you know, how are they using, you know, AI, and how many of them are using it? So apparently about 9 out of 10 people seem to be using it, right? I mean, so for things that are surprising, not surprising, because everybody knows that everybody uses this for code generation and documentation and, you know, obviously writing emails and making sure that you don't come across like rude and make it warm and all that kind of thing. So all those things are good, right? But interestingly, I've been seeing a lot more wipe coding of infrastructure, which sort of gives me nightmares, right? Right? I mean, so they're saying that, yeah, we're doing it for generating infrastructure file generation and those kinds of things. So when those things happen, I'm still struggling to sort of articulate like why that's a terrible idea, because I need to have some data to actually do it. So if you are put in that kind of a spot, how would you actually sort of articulate that? Because I want to make sure that, you know, I'm saying that you don't do it because you're going to do a poor job, but, you know, don't do it because of ABC. You know, so I think things that I think of is like, yeah, you're going to have an infrastructure that is not going to scale properly. It's going to have drifts and things like that, right? So have you encountered things like that? Or if so, how do you actually, you know,
right. That? Yeah, like how do you write the test? If you're going to have AI write the code, so to speak, well, don't let it write the tests. I mean, you know, it just gets in a loop. And of course, everything it does passes the test, even though it may not at all be what you imagined it would be behind the scenes. So if you're having it generate infrastructure, you know ahead of time, what is it? How would I test it to know that this had built it effectively from all those standards you said, resiliency and everything else? What are the tests I need to write? How would I know? Because if you don't, like I said, it's a black box on the other side. That doesn't know. It doesn't know if it did it right or not. It's like, you know, it's autocomplete or whatever. And I think it, you know, like what's the analogy for AI? It's like when spreadsheets were first invented on computers, Lotus 1-2-3. That's a brilliant, great tool. We never had anything, you know, green bar, we'd write it out by hand. It was wonderful. Spreadsheets don't know anything. You have to use them effectively to do stuff. And these are the same kind of thing. It's like, it's not better than the person using it. It'll eventually, and if it is, meaning if it's generated something that you don't understand and couldn't have written yourself, then, you know, good luck.
You know, I think, you know, I run a nonprofit on the side. You probably know this, right? So coming to the end of the year, I've been actually doing some, you know, reconciliation on that. I've been like really behind on that. So I started doing, I had some questions and I thought maybe I'll just go and ask ChatGPT for it, because how bad it could be, right? You know, I can tell you how bad it was. I lost about 5 hours on Sunday. I had to literally call Quicken or Intuit to actually get it fixed, right? So it's amazing. If you don't know what you're really doing, then you are in trouble. You know, unfortunately, I don't have a lot of accounting background, you know, so yeah.
Yeah, no, right. Yeah. And, why is it going so crazy? It's like, well, everybody's so desperate for it to succeed. And there's some valuable things happening. That's why it catches people's attention in the first place. But, you know, what we imagine it can be, what it enables you to create an argument in favor of, if you're some companies, for instance, they might be interested in increasing stock value to a point where, above all else, and it gives you a good argument to try some strategies that you normally wouldn't be able to get away with, kind of thing. But it's all going to come back. In other words, it's exactly. Value is still value. And so if it's not doing things effectively, it'll come back and catch it. Maybe, I don't know, if there's no competition left in your business, then depending on who you are, then maybe it doesn't matter. You know.
But we have seen this history repeats itself, right? And it's all going to come crashing down if you don't do it right. Yeah. Anyway, so Nick, it's such a pleasure talking to you and catching up with you again. So hopefully we'll chat soon.
Absolutely. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.